Good morning, everyone, and welcome to CSIS. My name is Jennifer Cook. I direct the Africa program here. We're delighted to hold a session today to help highlight the new Oxfam report that Ian Gary and Steve have authored. And I think the crowd today is a testament to how much interest there is in Ghana generally, and in particular this development in Ghana. Good things are happening in Ghana. I think the election, as we all know, was a major step forward for the country, which, you know, we tend to forget how many coups and disruptions Ghana went through in its history these days. The country's fairly evenly divided, but President Mills, the former opposition leader, eventually eked out a victory. I think the election in some ways helped really consolidate Ghana's international reputation, which has been very positive in recent years as an example of democracy, good economic management, and so forth. Ghana's also seen big economic investments in agriculture recently. I think that's very notable. The MCC Compact, which was one of the largest, over $500 million to strengthen rural and commercial agriculture. You've got the Gates Foundation involved in that, Kofi Annan's Alliance for a Green Revolution for Africa, AGRA, involved trying to do innovative things to build rural agricultural capacity. Hydroelectric power, China is very much involved in that area. So there's many things going on in Ghana, and I think it's becoming one of those magnet countries in West Africa that can have a demonstration effect in the broader region. There are obviously still big challenges of poverty and health, infant mortality, being big fiscal deficits that they're grappling with in recent years. I don't know if that was in anticipation of the oil boom or in the run-up to the election, but that's something that the new administration is going to have to deal with. And then into this comes this potential of an oil boon, and it could be a tremendous boon, I think, but as the report that Ian is going to describe puts forward, there are going to be big challenges that come with that. The questions are, does it up the incentives for corruption? How will it impact other sectors, other promising sectors of Ghana's economy? How prepared is the government to deal just technically with this and the institutions to provide adequate oversight and so forth? And various sectors of the government, the ministries, how prepared is the legislature to provide the critical oversight role there? And the legislature is divided pretty much 50-50 between the ruling party and opposition parties. Also, I think the role of civil society, the media, how prepared and how technically prepared are they to, again, play that important watchdog role that's going to be needed? There's a growing... Ghana is home to a growing number of think tanks, and I think they can provide that critical role in helping educate media, the parliament, and the ministries, and so forth. And we're very happy to have Steve here today, who represents one of those groups. So let me just introduce our panel. Ian Gary, the principal author of the report, along with Steve, is going to outline the big findings of the report. Steve Mantia will come in, fill in from his perspective. He helped research the report over the past year and a half. Ian is senior policy advisor and manager for Extractive Industries with Oxfam. Most of you probably know Ian. He's done a lot of work on these kinds of issues in the past. Prior to joining Oxfam, he was with Catholic Relief Services, but he's authored a number of reports, including Bottom of the Barrel, when he was with CRS, that's Africa's oil boom and the poor, got a lot of coverage on that. He's done a big report on Chad's oil, Miracle or Mirage. We had a very successful conference here on that, and goes back a long time on these kind of transparency issues. Steve Mantia is media and campaigns coordinator with the Integrated Social Development Center in Ghana, known as ISODEC. ISODEC is a rights-based research and advocacy organization It works on sub-regional issues. He's also a member of the Public Agenda's Executive Council. He represents the Coalition on the Ghana EITI multi-stakeholder group, has a background in journalism, trained in Russia and in London, with a degree in journalism and communication studies. Welcome, Steve, and thanks for coming all this way. Finally, for the more international perspective on this, we have Clive Armstrong, who is lead economist for oil, gas, mining, and chemicals department at the World Bank. He joined the IFC. He joined the IFC in 1993 after working for BP, so long versed in the oil industry. And I think we'll talk about the World Bank's role in this, the perspective, perhaps drawing on other experiences of countries that have gone through similar oil booms, and the challenges that lie ahead in helping Ghana manage this, manage the oil boom effectively. So with that, I will turn over to Ian, who will talk, I think, for about 20 minutes with the outline. We'll then have our panelists speak and open the room for questions and answers. So thanks very much, and Ian.
Thank you, Jennifer. And as Jennifer did mention, it's become a bit of a tradition for us to launch reports here, and we're very happy to be back at CSIS. This is the last stop for Steve and myself after presenting this report in London and Doha at the recent global EITI conference, and last week in Ghana itself. So we're very happy to have an opportunity to present this report to all of you in Washington. As Jennifer had mentioned, doing the research on this report is, you know, qualitatively different than, say, doing the research on the Chad report. There's a lot to note in the positive category in Ghana. It's a country that's widely perceived as one of the African success stories. It's on track to meet its Millennium Development Goal of having poverty in the country by 2015. But there is a lot of concern that the progress that has been made, both on economic development as well as democratic development, could be either boosted or undermined based upon how the oil boom is managed. I won't spend a lot of time on the resource curse effects, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, but there's been a strong association between oil booms and increased conflict, corruption, authoritarianism, loss of control of public spending, and other negative effects on the economy. So what I'd like to do now is give you a brief overview of what's happening in the oil sector in Ghana, look at how the government has been responding, and briefly present some of our recommendations. The Jubilee Field is a field offshore Ghana, which is expected to start production by the end of 2010 or 2011 with a production rate of 120,000 barrels per day, which is not large by global terms. If you look at, say, the 2 million barrels per day produced in Angola, for example, but it's certainly significant within the context of Ghana. And the IMF has predicted that over the period of 2012 to 2030, the government could receive at least $20 billion from oil revenues. And that's just from the Jubilee field. The Jubilee discovery was discovered and announced in the middle of 2007. And as you can see from the map, in the sort of the green blob on the bottom is the Jubilee field. And that lies about 39 miles from the coast, and it's quite near the border with Cote d'Ivoire. Right now, the proven reserves are 600 million barrels, and the upside is 1.8 billion barrels. There's ongoing exploration, and recent discoveries in the past few months have extended the known size of the field, and it's likely that the proven reserve figure could go up higher than 600 million. There's also a lot of associated gas with the field. In terms of the companies that are involved, if you can see, the Jubilee Field cuts across two oil blocks that had been licensed. One on the right is operated by Kosmos Energy, which is a Dallas-based company, which is mostly people from Triton Energy, which made the big Ceiba Field find in Equatorial Guinea a few years back. On the left side is the Deepwater Tano Field, which is majority owned by Tullow Oil, which is a UK-Irish company. So that has meant that there's a joint development of the field and a unitization agreement for the development of the field. This just gives you a picture of what the offshore exploration looks like in Ghana. All of the gray areas have already been licensed. There's a lot of interest and excitement in Ghana or in the international oil industry about Ghana since the discovery of Jubilee in 2007. So looking at the progress so far in Jubilee, drilling rigs are under contract. The floating production storage and offloading vessel that will be used for the project, the contract has been signed. The unitization agreement and the field development plan apparently still under negotiation, although we heard that the field development plan could be approved as of this week. But those documents have not been made public, so there's little information on that. In terms of the government role, the state company is the Ghana National Petroleum Company, GNPC. And over time, it's gone from a company that was very large and bloated, which had about 700 employees, even in a time where Ghana had really no oil activity. It's now much smaller, about 100. But because of the lack of real activity, GNPC started to play both a regulatory role and a commercial role. And so it would be the Ministry of Energy that would approve the field development plan, but really turning to GNPC. And so there's some built-in conflicts of interest around the way that that is structured. And the companies are looking at a very fast-track field development plan, looking at about 3 years from the discovery to first oil. So looking at the estimates of the cost for the project, around $3.1 billion to $4 billion for the first phase of the Jubilee field. It's envisioned that there will be a second phase that could increase production, but this is for the first phase. So the companies Kosmos and Tullow have been looking for financing. Kosmos has a lot of financing from some private equity firms. Tullow has been issuing shares as a publicly traded company and looking at a syndicated bank loan to raise about $2 billion. Also of note, the International Finance Corporation of the World Bank on February 19th approved financing for Kosmos and Tullow combined $215 million. And since the, as I mentioned, since the Jubilee field was discovered, there have been a lot of applications, 41 applications for licenses to the GNPC. There's not a lot of information about the licenses. The government has been using sort of a negotiated deals approach to issuing licenses. The government hasn't been using a bidding round process, so there's not a lot of public information. According to the Constitution of Ghana, Parliament has the right to approve all agreements for natural resource exploitation, but it's really unclear how this works in practice. And as far as Steve and I could determine, most parliamentarians only see a very short memorandum of understanding about the agreement rather than the agreement itself. The GNPC participates in every field or every license and has a carried interest or a free stake in each field of 10%. Now, there are other companies that are coming in, like Lukoil or Obscure companies like Young Energy Prize, which is a company from Luxembourg that's run by an ex-KGB official. So in terms of the contract information and fiscal terms, there's some information available. The GNPC has published some information about the fiscal terms for the Jubilee Field in national newspapers, but to date, the petroleum agreements haven't been disclosed and haven't been officially available. But it's quite heartening to note that after our week of events in Ghana last week on Saturday, President Mills pledged to disclose all petroleum agreements, and civil society groups this week had a meeting with the new Minister of Energy, who said they were scanning those agreements and preparing them to post on a government website. So that's certainly some positive progress. In terms of the fiscal terms, the royalty payments vary between 4% and 12%. I mentioned the carried interest. The GNPC has an option for additional paid interest in the field, the fields, and the President Mills has stated that they will take that option, valued at $161 million. And the petroleum income tax is set at 50% by law, but is negotiable, and it's 35% for the Jubilee Field. So in terms of what all that means for the government take, the projections are that the government take would be between 38 and 51%, but it could possibly be higher depending on oil prices and depending on the internal rate of return for the companies. There's a provision in the contract for additional oil entitlements triggered by profitability projections. And so if things went well, Ghana could receive 60% or more in terms of a government take. The chart at the bottom is a bit dated, but it comes out of a project that CSIS worked on in terms of the African oil sector, and it looks at a snapshot of government takes across sub-Saharan Africa from 2003, which showed Nigeria at the top with 80% and Chad at the bottom with 28%. And so if you took 60 as a nominal figure, you know, Ghana would fall somewhere in the middle. So in terms of how the government has been preparing for oil, and it's certainly important to note that the bulk of the research we did and the bulk of the action so far happened under the previous government of the NPP government of former President Kufuor. Last February, there was a national forum on oil and gas development that was originally meant to be a very public forum, but in the end only allowed three civil society members inside the forum. But since the forum, out of the president's office, six technical committees were established to look at the legal framework, the fiscal regime, how to use natural gas, environmental issues, local content issues, which are very much on the minds of Ghanaian entrepreneurs in terms of how easily will they be able to get contracts to feed in to support the oil industry. But the plan of the government, previous government, was to finish an oil policy, a master plan, and get that approved before they left office. But time ran out, and that hadn't happened. So what we have right now is a a leaked copy of a draft national oil policy, which is very slim and contains a lot of common sense principles but little detail. And we have a draft Petroleum Regulatory Authority bill, which was presented to Congress, or excuse me, to Parliament in October last year, nearly passed in the rump Parliament that left in January, but did not pass. And so what we have right now is a second draft of the Petroleum Regulatory Authority bill that is currently at Cabinet. Civil society groups had an opportunity last week to interact with the drafters of this bill. What it would do is create an independent regulatory authority. So in essence, splitting the regulatory and commercial functions of GNPC and creating this new authority. defining GMPC as a commercial entity, establishing regulations for the upstream and midstream sectors. The current legal framework for oil and gas production in Ghana is very weak and limited, and what exists are laws that were created under the military regime in the 1980s. The authority, the legislation partially defines the fiscal regime and establishes disclosure and confidentiality rules for the sector. So there are a number of positive features, and most notably, there's this recognition of the need to split the functions that GMPC has been performing. Other positive features are, for example, no gas flaring and public announcement of petroleum blocks. But there are a number of causes of concern in the draft that we've seen. One is that their extensive presidential powers, the president has the ability to appoint board members of the GPRA. There are questions about the funding and independence of the GPRA. Coming out of the mining sector, one of the major issues has been that the Minerals Commission has no functional independence because they don't have an independent source of funding. There's a lot of discretion in terms of the fiscal regime. At least two pages of secrecy provisions, including criminal penalties for disclosure of some sorts of information, and relatively little in the way of transparency measures. So the big question in Ghana is really how will the billions of dollars that are coming in be managed? And there are a number of weaknesses that have been identified in government revenue collection, in part through Ghana's participation in EITI and Ghana's experience in the mining sector. And a World Bank document in 2008 said that the government lacks the capacity to collect revenues and audit payments from gold mining companies. And what we certainly don't want to see is a replication of that on the oil sector, because the rents are many times larger in oil than in gold mining, where in recent years you might have had $100 million at most from gold mining. You're talking about billions coming in the oil sector. In terms of budget transparency, Ghana has a mid-range score of 49% in the Open Budget Index, which measures transparency and availability of documents like government pre-budget statements or audit reports, etc. And there are significant absorptive capacity issues, especially, for example, in health and education, where 70 or 80% of the money that's allocated to those ministries never gets to facilities like schools and clinics. So we talked to some donors who said, well, maybe $200, $300 million extra the government could absorb, but $400, $500 million more going through the budget each year, that might lead to waste. So there's a need to strengthen the procurement and competitive bidding processes, as well as auditing and oversight functions of the government. And because of this absorptive capacity issue, Ghana might need an oil fund of a certain type, whether it's a stabilization fund dealing with price shock effects on the budget, or some kind of future generations or heritage fund. And both of these have been discussed in Ghana, but there haven't been concrete steps on that front. So in terms of a transparency, and Steve can talk more about the progress on EITI, there's been some progress, but civil society has been frustrated with the fact that a lot of the recommendations coming out of the EITI reports have not been implemented, and the government has exhibited a reluctance to extend the EITI process to the petroleum sector. In addition, there's been talk of a Freedom of Information Bill in Ghana for the last decade, but no progress. One thing to note is that the recent IFC financing does require payment disclosure by Kosmos and Tullow on an annual basis, but we will need a broader transparency for all the companies that are involved, and hopefully that will be something that will be included in the next draft of the regulatory authority bill, but also legislation that will likely be reintroduced in Congress, the Extractive Industries Transparency Disclosure Act, could help capture more of those payments and help disclosure in Ghana. In terms of how the donor community has been reacting, Norway is seen as closest to the government on oil issues, has an official MOU through their Oil for Development program. The World Bank, the UK, France, Holland, and others have been involved in an environmental governance program. But what we saw was that there was a great need for increased information flow and coordination among donors. And because some of the companies come from the UK or Norway or the US, there at times could be possible conflicts of interest in terms of the kinds of advice that donors give in terms of the management of the sector and the commercial interest of companies involved. There's been a lot of attention in Ghana. I think outside, most of the attention has been related to how the money would be managed. Inside Ghana, a lot of the attention has been related to environmental issues. What are the possible impacts of oil development on fishing communities, coastal communities, et cetera? And all of this is seen through the lens of gold mining and the lack of capacity or political will to regulate the gold mining sector. In the mining sector, there was, you know, a great development of gold mining followed by regulations and the EPA role, but still the EPA has very limited capacity to regulate and has no capacity or experience in the petroleum sector. It's important to note that there will be a need to expand environmental regulations and strengthen them for the petroleum sector. And so we had a concern about the IFC approving the financing for this project before the completion of a production phase environmental and social impact assessment. There's a lot of tension, I would say, expectation among coastal communities about this project, whether it will provide jobs, whether it will damage the environment, whether it will restrict fishing. And so a lot of these expectations will have to be well managed by the companies, by the IFC, and by the government so that this kind of situation doesn't escalate. So just turning quite quickly to our recommendations for the government, we believe it's very important that you develop in sequence first a policy master policy, a master plan, regulations as a package rather than, for example, setting policy through the legislative process or through rules making, and that all of this involves robust public, civil society, and parliamentary participation. We've seen some early signs in this new government that there will be more openness and dialogue, which is positive. In terms of transparency, publication of all payments, disclosure of the unitization agreement and the field development plan, disclosure of petroleum agreements. We've seen a positive statement on that, and so we hope that will be followed through. Certainly extending the EITI process to include oil and gas and turning EITI commitments into binding laws in the way that Nigeria has done. One of the recommendations that we've made that might be a bit controversial is that we believe that there should be a moratorium on new exploration licenses and that it's important for the development of the oil sector not to outpace the development of the regulatory framework, the legal framework, and the capacity of various government institutions to cope with the development of the sector. On the GNPC and the GPRA, we've mentioned before separating their functions, avoiding conflicts of interest in the board, making sure that there's an independent funding source for the GPRA, and reducing confidentiality provisions in the bill. In terms of revenue collection, establishing a petroleum tax unit in Ghana's IRS is important. Steve can tell you more about how the capacity that had recently been built up to monitor mining payments has been lost, and so there's a real concern that Ghana will not capture all of the rents that are coming through the oil industry. In terms of oil funds, the discussion really hasn't gotten off the ground, but there are a number of common sense measures that can be adapted to any kind of oil fund, including adopting very clear rules for moving money into and out of the fund, and making sure that you have safeguards for that. The example of Sao Tome is interesting, where four different government officials from different agencies have to sign off on the yearly transfer of money from the fund into the government budget. On social and environmental issues, quickly establishing a process to manage the conflicting uses of the sea between fishermen, the oil industry, et cetera, needs to happen. And so far, there hasn't really been good information disclosed to communities or any attempt by the government to manage that situation. And that environmental impact assessments need to be completed before commercial development of fields begin. We also believe that free, prior, and informed consent of communities is needed before any licenses for onshore exploration. There is some talk about exploration in the Voltaic Basin, which would be onshore Ghana. So this has been a big issue for gold mining communities, and it's important that the mistakes that have been made there are not repeated related to onshore exploration. Parliament has a very active role, can play a very active role, and we hope to see that in this Parliament in terms of overseeing the sector, approving petroleum agreements, et cetera. And for donors, we'd like to see full transparency and civil society participation in the petroleum sector decisions as a requirement for technical assistance, and that the capacity building that's being provided move beyond the government to Parliament and other sectors of society. Finally, for companies, we hope that Tullow and Kosmos will quite readily comply with the requirements from the IFC to disclose their payments, that other companies will do that, that they'll become key members in EITI in Ghana and endorse this process, and look at conducting participatory, inclusive, and transparent environmental impact assessment process. So just to sum up on the key messages, the first is that the challenges posed by Ghana's oil boom are broad, deep, and complex and should not be underestimated. I think a lot of what we heard in Ghana from government officials is that, we understand the challenges, but we've got it under control, basically. We're not Nigeria. We're not Nigerians. And we've seen the problems, and this can be managed. And I don't have the sense that people really understand how significant these challenges are. That oil could quickly, over a few years, undermine gains made in Ghana on democratic governance and development. And that while there has been significant progress, we should not think that the progress is such that the progress is not fragile, because it is, and could be unwound quite quickly. A third point is that, speed is important, and government has the incentive right now, as Jennifer mentioned, to speed up production and get oil revenues to address financial needs. But haste makes waste, and one, you have to control the pace of the sector, as I mentioned, so it doesn't outstrip the ability of the government to manage it. That pacing can lead to better negotiated deals over time, and that if you sign a lot of agreements now with stabilization clauses, you'll lock in a weak regulatory regime. It's not something you want to do. The fourth point is that sequencing, transparency, and public participation are key to developing the policies, the plans, and the regulations. And finally, we believe that Ghana can learn from the experience in the gold mining sector, negatives and positives, as well as all the global good practice that's being discussed right now to manage its oil boom. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ian. We'll turn right to Steve. Steve, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Ian. I think it is important to emphasize the essence of this report, which is making sure we get it right. Ian makes allusion to the fact that Ghanaians say they are not like Nigerians. Yes, Nigeria is just next door to Ghana, and we see what oil has done to that country. And but somehow, on the lighter side, we say in Ghana that God is a Ghanaian. And so he allowed Nigeria to discover oil first, make all the mistakes, so we can learn from it. So we are hoping that we'll be able to learn and avoid the mistakes of Nigeria. The discovery of oil in Ghana, like we heard, has actually brought a lot of attention to Ghana. Our immediate past president, following the discovery of oil, made declaration of intent to manage the sector in a way that benefits all Ghanaians. But what really prompted the study was the fact that at some point we found a disconnect between what the government was saying and what was happening on the ground. And this started right in February 2008, when the government organized a round table conference to kind of mobilize ideas that were to input into a national draft oil policy and master plan. Participation was highly restrictive to civil society involvement. And I remember at that point we found some funds to organize a parallel meeting for civil society to collate our ideas and to consolidate them and relay them to government so they can be input into the discourses that were going on at the time. So we know the government has pledged to do things right. Sometimes without pressure, you might find government cutting corners. The sole point of the previous government was the fact that there was not much inclusion, not even some level of participation from the side of the then opposition party, which finds itself in government now, which is a reason the current government actually does not see its way clear in terms of how to proceed, because they really haven't been much involved in the processes from the beginning, which for us also as civil society groups provides opportunity to kind of engage the government, because it looks like the government would want to listen to all stakeholders with a view to actually forming an opinion and deciding on how to proceed from where we find ourselves now. The timeliness, therefore, of this report is borne out by the fact that as the government looks at how to chart the way forward, this report can inform or input into the discussions going on at this time in Ghana. For us as civil society, there is a lot of importance, as Ian mentioned, in the proper sequencing of events. We do not at the moment have a clear national policy for the oil sector. We do not have a regulatory institution in place, and GNPC, the Ghana National Petroleum Company, is kind of playing their role alongside its commercial functions. We do not actually have a proper environmental and social impact assessment conducted, and yet the IFC has gone ahead to approve a loan for the companies, which for us undermine our efforts to ensure that the proper thing is done in respect of oil development in Ghana. We are holding a series of meetings with the IFC, and we hope we'll be able to at some point reach some agreement in terms of how we ensure that at least we do not cut corners going forward. We also do understand the push on the government side, as also already alluded to get some money in quickly, because already we have spent the HIPIC benefits that accrue to the country. We also have, we raise some money on the capital market that has been spent, and the government has very little room for maneuver in preparing this year's budget and also the subsequent ones. And obviously there's this push on the part of government to get the money in quickly. Now, if you're not careful, you're going to get into a situation where in a rush to get money in, you actually shortchange the government and people of Ghana. And so we think, here again, we need a civil society to continue the pressure and ensure that this does not happen. As already pointed out, the current government appears to be much open in engaging with civil society and dialoguing with that. Following the launch of this report in Accra, the government has made a number of declarations. So we're not too clear whether
these announcements were informed by the launch of our report, but they are good signs, nevertheless, to note. One, the government has pledged to make publicly available all contract documents, and again, they have actually pledged that they are going to review the National Petroleum Law. It is not too clear what law the government has in mind, given, as it were, that we do not have a single law for the petroleum sector. There are a number of laws scattered, dating back from the military era in this country. Our proposition going forward is to kind of review all these existing laws and pull them together into one comprehensive national petroleum law for the country. The pronouncements of the government, it is important to note that are consistent with the recommendations of this report, and would want to urge the government to go by its pledges. We hope in making progress with Ghana's oil, this report and its recommendation will serve a useful guide. There are, though, and I think some of these were mentioned in Ian's presentation, present community issues that require urgent attention. And these are the social and environmental impacts. Already, there are some impacts on the districts bordering the oil find in Ghana. Fishermen are being restricted from areas where they fished for generations. People are moving into oil districts in search of expectant jobs in the oil industry. Companies, investors are also haggling for land and immovable property in the area. These are all kind of pushing the cost of living in these districts up. And it raises a lot of challenges for the local government of these districts, which is a reason there is a call from the districts for kind of a preferential treatment in the sharing of future oil revenues. It is important to draw your attention to the fact that in the mineral sector, the Constitution of Ghana provides for preferential treatment for communities, host communities to mining companies. This is informed by the fact that mining actually brings in its wake some kind of negative impact, and therefore the extra revenue to these local communities will help address some of these challenges. But the Constitution, I guess the framers of the Constitution were unaware that in 2007 Ghana was going to discover oil, and so they were quite silent in terms of what happens to future oil revenues. And this is actually causing a lot of disquiet in mining communities, and they are quite anxious, and they need to know whether or not the same provision relating to the mining sector will be extended to the oil sector, such that districts bordering the oil find do get some extra kind of share of future oil revenues to mitigate against any possible negative impacts of oil production in Ghana. There is currently also unhealthy competition among neighboring communities for this kind of preferential treatment, because there are about 4 to 5 districts bordering the oil find, and the question is which district should get what. And this is also, if not managed very well, could degenerate into inter-district conflicts and all that. So basically, we think and we hope that this particular report, which we are launching here today, would help us address some of the challenges highlighted in the research that we conducted. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Steve. Clive.
Good morning, and a thank you to the organizers for inviting me to talk here today. My background is in IFC. In fact, we have an IFC team in Ghana at the moment carrying out consultations with civil society and others about this project and about oil in Ghana, and I'll give you some comments on some feedback I had from them recently. We often find ourselves in the position of responding or addressing Oxfam reports, I can say, the reports I find are always excellent, but this is truly an excellent report, and it's very difficult to see why. It's quite clear that almost anybody interested in oil development in Ghana, whether the government, stakeholders, companies, is going to find this report a very, very useful report indeed. I mean, I think it lays out in an extremely well-balanced way the sort of possible benefits, but also the risks. More commonly, I think we find that people focus on the risk, but the degree of detail of this report gives an enormous amount of information and hope, I think, that these risks can be addressed. Let me talk about it from the bank's perspective. It seems to me that when we looked at the report and thinking about it, especially from the context of IFC that was put in a position by these companies as should we support these oil developments or not, we saw that this report describes a country that by lots of measures is relatively, compared to a lot of other countries, is relatively well prepared for the development of a new resource such as oil. That is to say, it is a country whose record, whose governance capacity, whose vibrancy and freedom of activity and information, the engagement of civil society and others, provides at least a reasonable basis for an oil development. But as the report points out, there are lots of things that could be done better. There's lots of things that could be done in terms of better information, capacity of government, planning, and so forth. I think that's no surprise, and that will always be the case. And we came to the view that these were a set of projects in a country that we felt we could reasonably support. I've recently had feedback from our team in Ghana, for example, who've had meetings with civil society and governments, and the government. And civil society have made to that team a lot of the concerns that have been expressed here, and I'll come to those in a minute. In meetings with governments, we have been told, as Ian has mentioned, that the contracts, for example, will be made public. In fact, we carried out an interesting experiment last week. They should have been public, I believe, under existing provisions in Ghana. So we asked a staff member to go along and get a copy from Parliament. And after a day or two of hassle, they managed to get a copy. My understanding is that all of these contracts will now be on the web by the end of the week, so it'll be much easier, but that's a good thing. My understanding is that there will be a process of public consultation about the draft, the GPRA bill. So the signs are that the new government has come to power, and is willing and able to engage with stakeholders on how to deal with some of these issues and risks that have been pointed out. When I think about oil and development, and I read, and particularly listening to Steve now, I think one of the biggest risks is that of expectations and perhaps unfulfilled expectations. I mean, Ghana is at a stage where it has this, what appears to be a very good oil field, which is going to produce oil and could, in 3 years' time, be producing oil at 120,000 barrels of oil a day. I mean, everybody who's been involved in the oil business knows, well, let's wait and see till the production begins. But if you were to take that level of production, and if you were to take the estimates in the book and pick a midpoint, it could be generating $300 to $500 million a year of revenue to the government at peak. That's a lot of revenue, a lot of potential for corruption, therefore a lot of risk. But it's not going to transform Ghana. I mean, it's probably going to enable, the Ghanaian government to increase spending by perhaps 10%. That's not a lot, you know, $20 per head of population per year. So it's not necessarily a huge flow of resources that is going to transform the economy. Yet when you read some of the literature, you get the impression that this is this huge flow of wealth that is going to be available for everybody. Now, we don't know what future oil fields will be developed. We don't know what the price of oil is going to be. And that's one of the uncertainties. And it's one of the big challenges the government has to deal with. I mean, if the price of oil is much higher, if there are more oil fields, then the mechanisms such as stabilization funds, heritage funds, et cetera, may be needed. But it's not 100% clear at the moment. And so trying to find out more information about that, some of which is only going to become available through exploration, is a challenge. And so the government is having to set policy and practice in some degree of uncertainty. I think one of the other areas of expectation that government, companies, and others need to address are communities' expectations. I've been involved in one meeting recently here in Washington with representatives from a community, and it's quite clear that different communities feel or say that they feel that they have some degree of ownership over oil, even though the oil is offshore. The degree of expectations about what communities are going to gain, given the nature of oil field developments, given the capital-intensive nature, given the lack of jobs and stuff, may be misplaced. And you can't change that, but governments have to think and the companies have to think about how, first of all, do they make available information in a way so that expectations are more realistic. And then, of course, as part of its spending process and political decisions, government has to decide what revenues will be used for. So if I were to summarize, I would say that Ghana in many ways seems to be doing a lot of the things that are right, but the future still has to unfold. And I think the specific risks which are identified in this report, some of the actions which are needed to be done, I think are exactly right. And with that, I'll leave it.
Thanks very much to all of you. Why don't we open it up for questions now? One question I did have for Ian and Steve, perhaps, is the security question. I wonder, has that come up at all? I mean, it is near Nigeria, the attacks in Equatorial Guinea make one wonder. I wonder if that's been a concern at all, kind of the maritime security aspect. Actually, Ghana has been among the more forward-looking on maritime security issues, and I wondered if you might want to comment on that. And then thinking about linkages to other sectors of the economy, to agriculture and the much bigger employers. I think Nigeria's experienced, the oil boom essentially collapsed the North's agricultural sector eventually. And then that makes the competition for the resources and among communities even more intense and just starts that entire cycle. So I wondered if you might, what's the thinking there on that? And then we'll open it up for, we'll take a couple of questions at a time.
You want to start with that?
Sure. And I'll ask Steve to add on. Out of the technical committees that the government established, one of them was related to security issues in the offshore oil sector. But we haven't seen any of the results of that committee or what kind of findings that they've made or recommendations that they're making. There have been issues or reports that Steve received in his research about the Ghana Navy intercepting fishermen. There have been issues of fishermen attaching themselves to drilling rigs or getting close to the oil operations. But the specific, maritime security in terms of any kind of, Niger Delta situation in Ghana, that hasn't been really discussed. I think Ghana has some work to do, for example, on the fishing side, to be able to control its maritime waters. And there are a lot of commercial trawlers who are fishing without licenses or with, the Navy turning a blind eye or the government turning a blind eye. So I think that's something that the security as well as linking into exclusion zones and where fishermen can fish, artisanal fishermen, is something that's important. The discussion really hasn't extended to the kind of Dutch disease effects that afflicted Nigeria, where Ghana's currency could be propped up by oil revenues, making other exports more expensive. It was something that was raised in our London discussion. We had a representative from Cadbury's Chocolate, which I found quite interesting. He was worried about what will happen to cocoa production. What will it mean for cocoa production? And that is, cocoa is a huge money earner for Ghana. So I do think that is something that needs to be put into the policy and planning mix in a real robust way, and it hasn't been part of the discussion so far. Steve.
Yeah, the issue of security, at least to civil society groups in Ghana, is very key in the discourses around oil. Sometime in last year, you know, Ghana already produces some little amount of oil from the salt pond field, which is about 600 barrels a day. And between salt pond and Accra, a ship carrying oil got vanished on the high seas. Obviously, it raised a number of concerns. The Navy is clearly under-resourced, and again, the human capacity itself of the Navy could do with some improvement. So that's an issue on our minds. On the question about the risk of an enclave economy and how oil links into the rest of the national economy is also an issue that it's a major demand that we are making of government for the National Development Planning Commission to be at the heart of the discourse around oil, the national oil policy. For now, it looks like the National Development Planning Commission is not much involved, and therefore it is unclear what role the oil sector, strategic role the oil sector will play in the entire economy of Ghana. I think it is important, and we will be pushing this angle for us to develop a kind of a strategy for the oil sector in a way that actually integrates the other sectors of the national economy. Thank you.
I wanted to offer a short comment and a question. The comment is that the discussion of secrecy provisions and general lack of transparency in the regulatory board's charter reminded me of the behavior of another commodity agency back in the 90s, the Ghana Cocoa Board, in 93, 94, 95 or thereabouts. It was assumed after the 92 election that the budget deficit would get back under control, inflation would go down, they'd get back on track. Didn't quite happen. Inflation stayed up in the 20% range. And it turned out eventually, after a lot of digging, that the fault was in the Ghana Cocoa Board arranging offshore financing off budget, under the table. And so that rang a few bells when you talked about lack of transparency here, and I would just cite that as a cautionary precedent. The question has to do with gas. All the discussion here was about oil, and of course I assume most of the discussion of EITI and so forth would apply to gas as well, but you also said that there would be no gas flaring, and so I'm wondering what the plans are for dealing with that.
Hello, it's Rosalind Kenya. I work for De Beers, but I'm from Ghana too, which is why I'm interested here. I have two related questions, and I think they're both for Steve. Which civil society organizations are actually involved in these discussions in Ghana? And I'm quite interested in how many of them are actually local civil society organizations. And the other question is, and who's assisting or advising government on negotiating the agreements with the companies, for example? And has civil society been engaged with the companies like Tullow and Cosmos? Because I, listening to the report, I didn't hear much mention of a sort of dialogue with the companies, which I think is important.
Thank you. My name is Noreen. I'm the economic councillor for Republic of Chad. And my country is almost very similar to Ghana in terms of oil production. In terms of quantity, most of issues discussion taking place is very close to Chad. I have something to ask all the speakers in two areas. In the area of revenue sharing and transparency. I need to ask to what extent Ghana revenue sharing and transparency is similar or close to Chadian oil production. I ask this question because this center has presented Chad oil production policies sometime last year, or at that time I was in Canada, but I have been reported that the presentation of Chad Oil was highly criticized by the person who was presented, one of the profs, in these two areas. And I believe that very few oil-producing countries in Africa having the measures that Chad took in these two areas. For example, in transparency, I believe the only country, not in Africa, but possibly could be on the earth, having its oil revenue figures on the internet, and also there is a board of managing the oil revenue, which is composed by Chad government, oil producers, World Bank, and independent international financial institution bodies, three of them. I don't know if such measures applicable to Ghana. In terms of sharing, I think to a large extent, the people of my country are discontent of the share, the fairness of the sharing. And this is one of our serious sources of political instabilities in Chad. People think that the oil companies, U.S. oil companies, which are producing oil in Chad, they are robbing their natural resources rather than sharing, because they believe $12.5 out of $100 is unfair. Still, the government trying to convince them that without such sharing, we are unable to produce such gas. And I don't know to what extent this center as a strategic study center, to what extent you think such sharing will contribute to transforming the nation and contribute to the stability, political stability, and social stability of newly oil-producing countries. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that, Ran. We'll turn here. Actually, I think the conference you were referring to was actually the rollout of Ian's report on Chad's oil sector, and so you're talking to the source here. I do think it raises an interesting point about the realities, the expectations, and then kind of continual public education on what it is and what it isn't, because the government take and so forth, that's been a huge issue in Nigeria. I think it's kind of misperceived in some ways by Nigerians and by groups who tend to target the companies, not realizing the government is actually taking 80%. I mean, so can it work both ways? But maybe we can start with Ian on this and work our way back.
Sure. Thanks. On the question that Ed asked about gas, it's a very important issue that hasn't had as much attention as oil in Ghana. The new government, the NDC government, and its political platform is quite interesting to read, because they are very focused on using gas to change the energy matrix of Ghana. And Ghana has, some may know, has had chronic problems recently in terms of electricity generation. So the new government sees the gas as an important opportunity for power generation, for value-added activities onshore. There's a lot of concern. Last week when we were in Ghana, I've never heard so much passion about an FPSO in my entire life, but people were looking at that as representation, visible representation of the enclave nature of the oil sector, that nothing would come onto shore, things would be processed on this FPSO and then shipped out to the global market. They see gas as an opportunity to build some of those linkages to the rest of the economy. The project has, the field development plan has 17 wells, and a number of wells in the initial phase will be used for gas reinjection. So the idea will be that they'll reinject gas into the reservoir to maintain pressure, but that there will be a plan to bring gas to shore. But those plans have not really been fully developed, and that's one of the reasons why the government rejected the first draft of the field development plan, and the second draft is under negotiation, is how the development of the first phase of the project will either enable or cut off options in terms of using gas for future development. Well, there was a joke for a while that this is unfortunately another IFC finance project, but that the gas took so long to come from Nigeria that by the time Ghana did its field, that they could send gas back to Nigeria. No, I don't see it as probably connecting, but being used within Ghana. On Rosalind's question, I'll let Steve answer most of that, but I would say that we have been engaging with the companies, that we have had meetings with Tullo and Cosmos in the course of researching this report, and last week, et cetera. We invited Cosmos to participate on this panel today, and they chose not to come. On the Chad question, it is an interesting question, and you'll see in the report in the introduction that I make some remarks about the differences between Chad and Ghana in terms of the political economy of the country when oil arrives. There is no revenue-sharing law in Ghana yet, such as Law 001 in Chad. And in terms of transparency, there is, you know, the existing EITI voluntary commitment and recent pledges around petroleum agreement transparency, but nothing like what was put in place in Chad. I think it's important to note the substantial changes that have happened in Chad since Law 001 was passed, and the fact that President Deby has made significant changes that weaken the revenue management system in Chad. And in terms of the questions around government take, Chad went from 12.5% royalty in the contract that was signed with Exxon in the 80s, and then the 2004 agreement signed with Exxon increased the royalty percentage by only 2 percentage points. So I would also question the capacity or the commitment of government negotiators to get a better deal in the second round. In the first round, you could talk about the inexperience as well as the fact that it was a frontier area. But in the second round, I find it hard to explain why the fiscal terms were not better significantly in the second contract.
Right. I want to address the question as to which civil society organizations are involved in the discussion around the oil sector. I'll say, in fact, there are about 20 local organizations, including faith-based organizations, organized labor, that's the Ghana Trade Union Congress, the National Catholic Secretariat, the League of Environmental Journalists, CDD, WASA Association of Communities Affected by Mining, Ghana Integrity Initiative, which is a local chapter of Transparency International, Center for Public Interest Law, Friends of the Earth Ghana, Friends of the Nation, and ISODEC. These are being led by ISODEC, and we are organized under the banner of Publish What You Pay Ghana. In terms of engagement with the companies, yes, we've had some contacts with the company, including even our own national GMPC. We also have approached the company and invited them to sign up to the EITI. They have expressed willingness, and at the multi-stakeholder steering committee of EITI, we are planning a sensitization workshop for the companies, including sector agencies and ministry for the oil. So there is some willingness on the part of the company to kind of engage. In terms of who is advising government on contract negotiation, it's not very clear, but what is clear is the fact that Norway seems to have the ear of the government and calling the shots, which is also causing some displeasure among the traditional development partners of Ghana, the DFIDs, the GTZs, and all who have been around helping the government of Ghana for years. And suddenly, a country that has not even a diplomatic mission in Ghana calling the shots in the oil sector. What host country retain as benefits and to the charting, I think, largely depends on the fiscal regime we set in place. But not just that, but also what provisions you make by way of local content in the policy arrangement. And therefore, for us in Ghana, we are paying a lot more attention in terms of what jobs are created and how local people benefit from the sector in terms of local content provision. Sometimes you can have these provisions in documents, but the challenge has been how to operationalize them. And this is what we want to, in the coming months, engage ourselves with. Thank you.
Maybe just say something on gas. I think the fact that there's gas there is obviously a very good thing. The fact that there is a no-flaring law is a very good thing and to be commended. Given the West Africa gas pipeline, in a way it gives, I think, the Ghanaian government a little bit of opportunity to get it right. Gas doesn't have to be wasted. I understand an IFC wasn't involved in the West Africa gas pipeline, although other parts of the bank group were, that the gas is now being tested and gas potentially could be delivered through that pipeline. So in a sense, Ghana has the opportunity, that's right, to sort of phase in this new offshore gas in an optimal sort of way. Just one comment on the sharing of benefits. This sort of description of percentage takes is a very standard way of doing it and sort of gives you a reasonable first cut estimate of sharing of benefits. But in our experience, the way we look at benefits is we try to get our project models and do a net present value, which takes account of the discounted flow of costs over time. And you can get quite different results. Our perception is the Ghanaian contracts seem quite reasonable, and in a range of contracts it would seem reasonable. I'm not sure about the Chad, whether the 28% is maybe a little bit misleading, but I don't have the information with me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Roman Shpak from National Democratic Institute. I have two quick questions. One has to do with the role of parliament. In your discussions with parliamentarians in country, how would you assess the parliamentarians themselves view their role in the process? To what extent are they involved in sort of active substantial discussions with the government? And also, in terms of capacity of the relevant committees within parliament, how would you assess the current capacity to deal with this issue? The second question is on the role of the media. There was a lot of discussion here on high expectations as well as attempts to create greater transparency and freedom of information. To what extent is the media able to take advantage of those issues once they develop? And to what extent is media responsible for sort of exacerbating some of these expectations currently? Thank you.
Dr. Maundonoji Gilbert from Chad, from civil society. I want to make one comment and ask one question. My comment relates with my Nuren's question. Firstly, I agree with him that the contracts and agreement with Chad government and companies is not at the advantage of Chad, but it is not the problem of companies. It is the problem of our government, and World Bank supports our government to negotiate with oil companies. This is why we haven't a lot of income or royalties from oil exploitation in Chad. Regarding the problem of mechanism of transparency, the mechanism of transparency in Chad, if we look at, we can say it is the best in the world. But since 2006, this mechanism don't work, and the money is waste to other use than for social investment for population. That is the comment I would like to make. And regarding the Ghana situation, the question I would like to ask to Jan and Steve is that Ghana is now known as an established democratic country in Africa. And what is or what will be the main threat for democracy in Ghana in the context of oil exploitation? That is my question.
Hi, Stephen Murray from Pan-African Capital Group. We are long-term investors in Ghana, particularly in the financial sector. My question to the panel is, I wonder if you could maybe share your insights on what you think will be the differences in how the NDC manages the economy versus what the NPP, how their approach was to economic management. Certainly, oil on the horizon is a very exciting thing for Ghana, but if you look at their current fiscal situation and the deterioration over the last few years, it's been both kind of rapid and also alarming. And I think today or yesterday, Fitch, the rating agency, came out and said that Ghana is much more likely to be downgraded than upgraded, and raised some real concerns. And then one small comment on Norway. I know they don't have full diplomatic, presence in Ghana. They do have a council or a consulate office. And I can tell you that Norway were very, very quick to approach the Ghanaian government to offer their assistance. And I think part of the reason Norway is in the position they are is because they acted faster than the rest of us. I know that when we got our act together to go to the government to offer our assistance and the assistance of some of our partners to manage the oil, which was very quickly after the discovery, they said, oh, we've already, you know, been talking to the Norwegians for a long time about it. So I commend them for their kind of being quick off the mark. Thank you.
Thank you. Bert Ubamadu at Fairmont Capital Strategy Group. Oxfam and ISODC should definitely be complimented for doing what you're doing. I mean, this is great that we're not going down 40, 60 years down the line saying, oh, God, what we should have done. On that, with regards to local content, Ian, you mentioned it a little bit, and Steve, you've elaborated somewhat, but I wonder if you could go into more detail as to, one, what's the current capacity? I realize engineering won't be oil engineers or petroleum engineers, but certainly lots of engineers in Ghana. Has that been looked at? And then secondly, what's the plan for technical assistance capacity development within the local population? And is there a plan with the new oil regime coming up to institute a local content law? One of the reasons why I think Norway is there is that they're viewed as sort of one of the preeminent countries on this, and you know, Angola has one, Nigeria is working on it now after 60 years. Is there some thought of maybe institutionalizing that concept now so that local participation for every company that comes in, they realize that there's an obligation there? Thank you.
I'll begin with the role of MPs and all that. I would acknowledge that the MPs in the Parliament of Ghana will deal with some capacity building in respect of oil issues. Though the Parliament in Ghana has oversight responsibility over the executives, what we found out in the course of this research is that oil contracts that go before Parliament are not very detailed. And sometimes when you don't have a very detailed document, you're not too sure what you are approving. And that raises a lot of concerns in terms of the oversight role of Parliament. Of course, it is the responsibility of parliamentarians to call for any additional documents that they think they need to actually form an opinion on a contract document. But more often than not, this does not happen. And so the challenge will be how to make parliamentarians aware of this particular kind of responsibility. On the part of the media, again, one would acknowledge that oil is a very specialized area, and again, here the media will deal with some kind of training in terms of reporting on oil issues. From the beginning, if you look at the Scandinavian media, reporting had been very sensational, and which is partly the reason there's so much expectation, and especially among community people, in respect of what oil will do for Ghana. Now, if this is not managed, then you can run into trouble when these expectations are eventually not met. So we do, and as part of our strategy, the ISODEX strategy, is to cultivate some relationship with key media people, senior journalists, and provide them with the adequate training and take them along our advocacy program so that they can have a much deeper and well-informed understanding of issues in the Ghana's oil sector, so that this will reflect in their reporting. This will take time, indeed, because we're only a small organization and we can only do so much at a time. The threat of oil to Ghana's democracy, there's so much here. And as I highlighted in my submission earlier, what we want to avoid in Ghana is a Nigeria kind of scenario. Now, if you have a situation where local communities feel shortchanged, obviously you cannot rule out unorthodox means of getting attention to their demands. And so these are some of the challenges. Again, there is the potential for rent-seeking behavior on the part of public office holders if you do not have transparency in the way contracts are negotiated and all that. And this could also put in danger for our democracy. In terms of Norway, I would want to also put on record that the Norwegian consulate was closed before we discovered oil. So currently they do not have a consul in Ghana. Is it Denmark? Is it Denmark, which represents the interests of Norway? I've had the opportunity of dealing with the Norwegians because I was part of a beneficiary of the Petra training in Norway, and I've had very close contact with the Norwegians. It's Denmark that actually handles the Norwegian interest in Ghana, which we think is not proper. They need to be there. Again, in terms of the problem we have with the Norwegian involvement is the fact that Norwegians only talk to government. They don't talk to civil society. So you're not too sure what they are saying to our government, and that's problematic. In the case of our traditional partners, the DFI, the GTZ, they have a window of opportunity to actually get a second opinion on issues in Ghana, and also dialogue constantly with civil society. And I think the Norwegians, if they want to actually be part of the process in Ghana, they must be more open than they have been so far. Thirdly, in terms of conflict, there's also the potential of conflict of interest, because there are Norwegian companies bidding for contracts in the Ghana oil sector. So if you are the one advising our government, and at the same time your company is actually having an interest in the oil sector, it raises some concerns, and especially when you are not very open in terms of your negotiations and dealings with the government. Thank you.
Interesting. I regret my very flip comment before. So, we can have a later discussion on Chad, but we're going to focus on Ghana today. It was great to hear your input, though.
Just to take up this issue about the concerns about economic management, I'm not an expert. I'm not sure how different this government will be. But I think your point raises an important issue, and it was something I alluded to, is that oil is not a panacea, and the government needs to have good fiscal management policy starting from now. So it is an urgent issue. On the issue of Norway, who we work with cooperatively in a lot of places, I mean, all I can say on that is that I think it is a threat Ghana is a country that a lot of people want to get involved with and help. And that can pose risks and dangers, I think, where government is getting different sources of advice from different donors. And so a reasonably good development, I think, is the donors are trying to make more of an effort to get together and coordinate to ensure that they sort of speak with a coherent voice when they talk to the government of Ghana. Finally, just on the local content issue, you know, when you look at the nature of this development, the capacity for local content, at least in this phase of the oil development, is extremely low. I mean, there is the capacity to produce, to provide certain sort of services in the form of servicing the development, but it is very low. My understanding is there aren't any specific percentage requirements in any of the contracts at this stage, and that's probably a sensible decision given the early stage of Ghanaian oil development. I mean, I think it's one of these longer-term decisions, how much development is going to take place over a longer time, that the government has to see and then think, well, what sort of requirements, what sort of training, what sort of infrastructure investment would be needed to build up a more sophisticated oil sector services industry. Thank you.
On the question of parliament, I think is vitally important, and we found that parliamentarians in Ghana, they don't benefit from the things that members of Congress here would take for granted, such as a congressional research service or professional staff for committees. So it's really a big project to increase the role of parliament, to work with the Select Committee on Energy so that they understand what they're signing off on or can play a more active role, definitely. The same with the media, and we hope that the way that the report has been written and will lead the media to a greater understanding of the sector, but also it's full of story ideas or things that they could follow up on themselves. And judging by the interest and the coverage last week in Ghana, I think that will happen. I think there are a lot of capable journalists. The issue is that they're new to the oil sector. I found it amusing when we were in the launch, and one of the journalists from the Daily Graphic, which is the biggest newspaper in Ghana, said, "What is this FPSO? I don't know what it is." And so then we explained it. And then the next day the article came out, and it called it a filthy production storage and offloading vessel instead of a floating production storage and offloading vessel. So now that the filthy FPSO is now part of Ghanaian lore. But I hope that they, will be able to start learning what the questions are. We did I did a training for a journalist in Cambodia on revenue streams and contracts and other issues, and we'll be working with Steve and others to try to get more training to journalists in that country. I think on the question of local content, which is a very hot issue in Ghana, the draft Petroleum Authority bill has local content requirements in it, and I could share those with you. There is discussion about creating a petroleum sector training program at the University of Science and Technology in Kumasi. I don't know if the IFC might have plans in terms of technical assistance for vendors and suppliers in the way that they did in Chad. One of my concerns, two concerns about local content. One is that often what happens is that there is a lag between the training and the capacity building, et cetera, and the opportunity to actually take the contracts. So there's a mismatch there. The second, and I think possibly more important, that local content requirements often have the perverse effect of feeding and entrenching political patronage systems, where you have a quote-unquote local Angolan company, but it doesn't actually have the capacity to do what they're contracted to do, so they get foreign expertise. It becomes a foreign company taking a local contract under the guise of being an Angolan company, and so that is really not a road that I think Ghana wants to go down. So if there is a local content requirement, you have to make sure that there are actual Ghanaian companies who can do the job. And I won't beat up any more on Norway than it has been already.
Listen, we're out of time. I want to say thank you to our panelists and for the report, which I think, as you see, is extremely rich and very balanced and very constructive, I think, as we go forward. I want to say thank you to Dave Hennick for pulling this together. I also want to put in a pitch. We have a conference this afternoon on Kenya, bringing civil society leaders to talk about the year post-election crisis, the progress made, the challenges ahead. That begins at 2:30, 2 to 5 this afternoon. But let's thank our panelists, Ian, Steve, and Clive.